This is Paula Kaufman, returning with the Herald and Review, dated September 21st, 2016. We will continue with the death notices. Charles Elmer Butler, Decatur. Charles Elmer Butler, 25, of Decatur, passed away Monday evening, September 19th, 2016, at Heartland Manor Care in Decatur. Graveside services to celebrate the life of Charles Butler will be 11:30 a.m. Thursday, September 22, 2016, at Macon County Memorial Park. Visitation will be from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Thursday at Morin and Goebel Funeral Home. John Frederick Quartz, C-O-R-D-T-S, Decatur. John Frederick Quartz, 72, of Decatur, Illinois, passed away Thursday, September 15, 2016, at his residence. Condolences may be left to the family in care of Britlinger and Earl Funeral Home. Willie Sonny Green, 72, of Decatur, passed away Friday, September 16, 2016, in Decatur Memorial Hospital. Services to celebrate Willie's life will be 11 a.m. Saturday, September 24, 2016, at the Life Builders Church, 833 West Pershing, Decatur, Illinois, 62526. Visitation will be 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, September 23rd, in Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Interment will be at Graceland Cemetery. Nathan M. Gully, 17, of Mohiqua, died September 17, 2016, in St. John's Hospital, Springfield, Illinois. Funeral services will be 10 a.m. Thursday, September 22, 2016, in First Christian Church of Mohiqua. Visitation will be from 3 to 6 p.m. Wednesday, September 21st, also in First Christian Church of Mohiqua. A memorial service will follow at 7 p.m. in Central A&M High School, Mohiqua. Burial will be in Westside Cemetery, Mohiqua. Sharon K. Lynch Johns of Charleston, formerly of Decatur, born 11-17-47 to James and Lily Golliday, went to be with Jesus on 9-10-2016. Graveside services to celebrate Sharon's life will be 1 p.m. Saturday, September 24, 2016, in Graceland Cemetery. David B. Kessel, 70, of Lakewood, passed away Sunday, September 18, 2016, at Sullivan Rehab and Healthcare. Cremation rites will be accorded, and per David's wishes, there will be no service. David's family invites friends to share a story or light a candle in his honor at www.lockhartgreenfuneralhome.com. Deirdre Marie Kornfeld, 64, of Grand Junction, Colorado, passed away September 9, 2016, in Hope West Hospice. Memorial services will be 11 a.m. Saturday in First Lutheran Church. Memorials to First Lutheran Church. Catherine E. Lacey, 81, of Decatur, passed away in Fair Havens Christian Home on Sunday, September 18, 2016. A celebration of life will be 11 a.m. Friday, September 19, 2016, at Morin and Goebel Funeral Home. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service. Burial will be in Point Pleasant Cemetery. Kenneth Douglas Reeder crossed over into heaven on September 15, 2016, peacefully at his home in Decatur. A private family service was held with interment at a later date. Wilson Park Funeral Home, 200 East Main Street, Rochester, Illinois, is in charge of. Inez Faye Smith, 79, of Arthur, Illinois, passed away at 12 a.m. on Sunday, September 18, 2016, at St. Mary's Hospital in Decatur, Illinois. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, September 24th, 2016, at the Arthur Church of Christ, 415 West 4th Street in Arthur, Illinois. Reverend Ron Bartanen will officiate. Burial will be held in the Friends Creek Cemetery in Argenta, Illinois, around 12:30 p.m. on Saturday. Visitation will be held from 10 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. on Saturday at the church. Isaiah M. Tuppence, 16, of Assumption, died September 17, 2016, in St. John's Hospital, Springfield, Illinois. Visitation will be from 3 to 6 p.m. Wednesday, September 21, 2016, in Assumption Christian Church. A memorial service will follow at 7 p.m. in Central A&M High School, Moequa. Class action lawsuit against State Farm approved. By Edith Brady Lunny, Lee News Service writer, Bloomington. A federal judge in Southern Illinois has approved class action status for a lawsuit accusing State Farm of violating federal racketeering laws by directing money into the election campaign of a state Supreme Court justice in hopes of influencing a ruling. About 4.7 million policyholders with the Bloomington-based insurance giant could benefit from an estimated $7.6 billion payout, according to Clifford Law Offices, the Chicago-based law firm representing the policyholders. The lawsuit before U.S. District Court Judge Dave Herndon is a violation of the Racketeer Influenced and Corruption Organizations Act, commonly referred to as RICO. The lawsuit is related to an alleged plot to influence a decision by the Illinois Supreme Court on an appeal of a $1.05 billion verdict against State Farm in a 1997 lawsuit, Avery versus State Farm. That judgment was based on a contention that State Farm authorized non-factory parts for repairs on cars involved in accident claims between 1987 and 1998. The alleged scheme to defraud policyholders involved State Farm creating a pipeline of campaign contributions that ended up in the coffers of the committee to elect Justice Lloyd A. Carmeier to the Illinois Supreme Court. State Farm funneled millions of so-called dark money through donations to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which then sent the money onto a political action committee and the Illinois Republican Party for use in Carmeier's 2004 campaign, according to the lawsuit. After he was elected in November 2004, Carmeier cast the deciding vote in favor of overturning the appellate court ruling that upheld the billion-dollar verdict in the Avery case, contends the lawsuit. Carmeier, who is not a defendant in the case, was named Monday by the Illinois Supreme Court to serve as its next Chief Justice. State Farm was accused in a 2012 lawsuit filed by two Texas men of hiding the alleged donations and its intent to influence the Supreme Court decision. With the new ruling giving that lawsuit class action status, the estimated settlement could now exceed $7.6 billion, according to Clifford. In a response Tuesday, State Farm spokesman Justin Tomczak said the company was disappointed in the court's decision on the class certification question and respectfully disagreed with it. We intend to ask the appellate court to review this ruling in the very near future. Plaintiffs have unsuccessfully asserted and reasserted these allegations for many years and should not be permitted to do so any longer. A hearing to review the status of the case is set for October 15. Merger plans have farmers tied in knots, by Stu Ellis for the Herald and Review. The agricultural community did not want to see another agribusiness wedding, and as soon as Bayer and Monsanto announced their engagement, farmers were on the front row when the Senate Judiciary Committee on Tuesday held a wedding reception. The latest merger of agribusiness titans announced last Wednesday was the year's fourth that puts farm income in jeopardy of further declines. Dow and DuPont earlier this year announced their intentions, which combines Dow's agroscience unit with DuPont's Pioneer Seeds. After Monsanto failed in its attempt to absorb Syngenta, ChemChina made an outright purchase of the Swiss seed and crop chemical company. In the past week, the headlines focused on Bayer of Germany buying Monsanto and the merger of Canadian fertilizer companies Agrium and Potash Corp. Farmers, whose income has declined 56% in the past 3 years, with more declines forecast this year and next, have been beset with higher crop production costs at times of low commodity prices. Fertilizer is the largest cost, and with the Canadian merger, the combination would control nearly two-thirds of North American potash capacity and nearly one-third of phosphate and nitrogen capacity. While corn and soybean values have retreated more than 50% in the past four years, the cost of seed has remained at an all-time high, with little relief seen for the 2017 planting season, and none foreseen in the future if six global seed companies become only three by the end of next year as they plan. That is why farmers cheered when their leadership announced they plan to testify at Tuesday's Senate hearing. Committee Chair Senator Charles Grassley, Republican of Iowa, himself a farmer with his son, said, "To me, it looks like this consolidation wave has become a tsunami." After specifying many concerns, Grassley said, "There's a lot of interest in how these transactions will recalibrate the seed and chemical world and whether they'll pass regulatory muster. Gavel down." After testimony from DuPont, Syngenta, Bayer, and Monsanto, "I am sorry ChemChina declined our invitation to testify," said Grassley, it was the turn of farm organizations to create thunder. Chief Economist Bob Young of the American Farm Bureau pointed to the farm income issue, saying, "This is one of the steepest declines in farm income on record. Let me just say that if this income situation does not turn around in the next year or so, we will have a sector under a great deal of stress when we write the next farm bill." AFBF is suggesting that the review of these mergers consider not only the market concentration and structure that will result from the individual company actions, but examine the structure of the entire industry in a post-merger environment. CEO Chris Novak of the National Corn Growers, who also represented the American Soybean Association at the hearing, said, "If our analysis determines that competition is decreased or costs would be increased significantly, both NCGA and ASA support the principle that the Department of Justice should apply remedies, including divestiture and/or rejection of a merger, should the merger be judged harmful to market competition." Novak said the ChemChina purchase of Syngenta raises issues of China giving preference to Syngenta seed genetics regarding importation of grain, and to retard the approval of genetic traits from other companies, which would create an international trade issue. Added Novak, "The speed at which the industry continues to consolidate and the tenuous state of our farm economy dictate that we work diligently to ensure that our farmers will still have access to a range of technologies without suffering higher costs. But where that range of technologies originates is a real concern. If the Bayer-Monsanto and Chem-China-Syngenta mergers occur, then nearly 100% of the important crop biotechnology research will be controlled in Germany and China. That will spur a lot of phone calls from one combine cab to another. It may be back to basics for Illini by Mark Tupper, H&R Executive Sports Editor. Champagne. Lovey Smith ran his Illini football team through a hard practice Tuesday, and he did it behind closed doors as he prepares to spend his bye week making his first recruiting trip in more than 20 years. Because Illinois does not have a game this weekend, Smith has scheduled just two practices, and he scrapped the normal practice of letting the media watch the first 30 minutes of the session. Tuesday, and again today, the practices are closed, and on Tuesday's Big Ten Conference media teleconference, Smith said he was considering changes in the wake of consecutive lopsided losses to North Carolina and Western Michigan. "We're going back to some training camp-type practices and work to clean up some things," he said. "We're going to look at all parts of what we've been doing, whether that's changes to the lineup or some of the schemes. We're evaluating all of those things." Players who were made available to the media following practice said Tuesday's practice was physically demanding. "It was a very hard practice," said senior center Joe Spencer, who was drenched in sweat. "I don't know what the play count was, but we were going hard, and that's what we needed. We were tackling live today. It was a good day, a productive day. Now we'll come in tomorrow and have another productive day. It was a great day of work, and that's what we need going forward." Spencer said it was difficult on Sunday when the team assembled to watch video of the 34-10 loss to Western Michigan. "This week put a really, really bad taste in a lot of people's mouths," Spencer said. "It's a really big punch in the gut, a slap in the face. It was a hard film session to watch. When you walk off the field and a reporter tells you we ran for 3 yards after sacks were put in, that's just not acceptable. That's what we talked about." Smith said watching the game film wasn't pleasant, but the problems weren't hard to diagnose. "It's pretty simple. We have to block them better. The run game works when you win up front, and we didn't win up front. We have to get helmets on everybody and get some push. And the running backs, most of the time you have to make one person miss, and we have to stay committed to the run, too." The Illini coaching staff will take advantage of the open weekend and hit the road recruiting. During practice, defensive line coach Mike Farr was seen getting a head start, marching off with his luggage. Lovey Smith said he'll be hitting the road too, something he hasn't done since his college days. He coached college football from 1983 to 1995 at Tulsa, his alma mater, Wisconsin, Arizona State, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Ohio State. "We're flooding the area. Every coach who can go out will be out, including me," he said. "I'm looking forward to it. It's been a long time for me since I've been in a high school, but it comes back to you pretty quick. I'm looking forward to seeing some high school practices and high school games, letting guys see us. We've been communicating in a different way until now, but letting them see you in their school means something." Smith modestly said he felt he was a good recruiter during his college coaching days. "Everybody has a history, which you can look up," he said. "I'm pretty proud of what we did. I have a few guys who have gone on and done good things. I'm proud of that." Notes. Defensive back Dylan Casley from Charleston left the practice field wearing a cast on his right wrist. He did not play in the Western Michigan game, but Smith rarely shares injury information, and did not regarding Casley. Two offensive linemen, who were starters in the season opener, were not in pads Tuesday. Tackle Austin Schmidt, who left the Western Michigan game in the first quarter but did not return, and guard Gabe Meginson, who missed the Western Michigan game, watched from the sideline Tuesday. Also not wearing pads were wide receiver Dez Kane and safety Caleb Day. Normally, the team photo is taken on media day prior to the start of the season, but Lovie Smith wanted to delay the picture in case the roster changed. The official team photo was finally taken Tuesday. Triathlon tradition to continue by Ryan Voiles, H&R staff writer. Decatur. The Rodney T. Miller Lakeside Triathlon has been a summer staple of Decatur for a decade. And while officials announced earlier this year that the triathlon, under that name, would end after its 10th year, race director Gene Muller said Tuesday afternoon that a triathlon would return to Nelson Park next summer. The event will now be known as simply the Lakeside Triathlon and will continue to hold down the same July dates as its forerunner. It'll have a new name, logo, and look, but hopefully it'll have the same feel to it, Muller said. For several months, Muller said he has heard from numerous athletes and members of the community about their desire to see a triathlon continue in Decatur. After discussions with those on the committee who helped to put past triathlons together, the decision was made to keep it going in some form. The initial triathlon was created in 2006 to honor the memory of Rodney T. Miller, a 40-year-old Illinois State Police Sergeant from Decatur who was killed in the line of duty in a 2006 traffic accident. His widow, Carla, helped to spearhead the event that has seen hundreds from across the state and Midwest sign up, including more than 300 participants in this July's triathlon that included courses for both adults and youth. But Carla Miller said earlier this year that after much thought, she was ready to move on from the event. Both Carla and Rodney Miller's father have given their blessings toward the continuation of the triathlon, Muller said. We're keeping the title Lakeside Triathlon, as it still keeps Rodney's legacy. But we're also moving forward, Muller said. Money raised through past triathlons has gone towards youth sports programs in the area, and Muller said the plan is to continue to raise money toward that cause. At the end of the day, Muller said the main reason to bring back the triathlon was to continue what has become a local tradition. It is one of those special events that Decatur has, he said. We have some of them, but it would be a huge loss for this one to go away. Central A&M pulls together to defeat Clinton. H&R staff reports. Moquegua. On an emotion-filled night on their home court, the Central A&M Raiders volleyball team pulled together. Tonight was a good training point for us as a team, Central A&M coach Vanessa Rourke said of a 25-22, 25-20 win against Clinton. They played unified, they played hard, they played tough, and that was reflected in the score. I also want to thank Clinton for their support regarding recent events within our community. The support from their fans and their team alone was unbelievable. Abby Fourlines and Taryn Sams led the way for the A&M offense with 10 and 7 kills, respectively. Mount Zion defeats Taylorville, 25-20, 25-18. Taylorville. The Tornadoes' defense covered the floor all night, but the Braves served and hit too well to be denied the victory. Aaron Ripple led Mount Zion with 7 kills, but Braves coach Jay McAtee said Taylorville's defense did everything to keep that total from climbing. Defense on both sides was really good, McAtee said. We were held to a season-low 20 kills, and a lot of that had to do with their defense. Freshman Stephanie Herm had three aces, as the Braves had just one serving error. Taylorville pushed Mount Zion with its service game as well. They were serving very aggressively and taking risk, and we did a pretty good job of getting control of their hard serves, McAtee said. Shelbyville defeats Tuscola 25-13, 25-10. Shelbyville. Even when Kaylee Wheeler and Kaylin Wilson didn't drop an ace, the Rams pounded the ball at the service line to throw off Tuscola's attack. Wheeler finished with five aces, and Wilson had three, as Shelbyville won big in conference play. We had a great night at the service line with huge runs from Kaylin and Kaylee, Shelbyville coach Lisa Pfeffer said. Not getting strong passes helped keep them from attacking very aggressively, and we were able to then keep them on defense with great swings of our own. Those came from Maddie Holland, 7 kills, and Sydney Miller, 6, and Shelbyville improved to 16-1. WSS defeats Neoga 25-17, 25-9. Windsor. Despite not being at full strength, Windsor Stewardson Strasburg handled business Tuesday night. We really had to work through the heat on top of illness, WSS coach Rhonda Schlechte said. Set one was rough, but we were able to bounce back and take set two with only a few errors. Mackenzie Tabbert had 5 kills, 4 aces, and 5 digs. Megan Schlechte had 7 kills and a pair of aces. Mattoon defeats Effingham 25-9, 25-13. Effingham. Everything went right as Mattoon bulldozed its way to another win. The big thing we have been emphasizing in practice is minimizing the errors, and I think we took a good step tonight, Mattoon coach Mark Jackley said. Our ball control was pretty good tonight. Summerlin Smith rotated her options, setting up 21 assists on the night. Boys soccer. Mattoon 7, Mount Zion 0. Mattoon. The Wave just missed early, but that didn't happen much more throughout the night. We hit the crossbar 13 seconds into the game, Mattoon coach Ryan Gear said. I thought we played well the whole game. Greg Thorne picked up 2 of the 7 goals, and he assisted on a pair as well to break the school record for assists. Thorne currently sits at 32. He's been our leader. He's unselfish, and he's just so quick, Gear said. When he turns the corner and lays the ball off, he's tough to defend. Mattoon's only non-win came in a draw against Charleston. Since then, the Wave have won 9 straight. This has been Paula Kaufman with the Herald and Review, dated September 21st, 2016. I look forward to reading with you again soon.